and welcome to a very special Film Ireland podcast in partnership with Access Cinema. The Japanese Film Festival takes place from April 9th to the 27th across the country. And ahead of their fantastic programme, we'll be chatting with Adam Torrell. He's the head distributor of Third Window Films. But first, we'll speak with Maeve Cook, the director of Access Cinema, about this wonderful festival. Thank you so much for chatting with us ahead of the festival.
No problem, Gemma. Thanks for having me.
Are you all excited? There's got a good array of films, like a fabulous selection of locations.
Yeah, I mean, it's always really surreal, I guess, when you get to that point where you're just about to start any festival, I think, and particularly with this festival, because it covers so many locations over quite a short period of time. So I guess excited, yes, just to be able to finally share the films that we, myself and Stephen, primarily have been looking at, for the bones of a year now and shortlisting and curating, and then to actually get a chance to see how people are going to react to those films. That's always, you know, kind of the exciting part. But there's always a certain amount of, you know, relief as well to just... Okay, it started.
So talk to me about the audiences who come to the festival.
Again, I guess at the very beginning, the audiences would have tended to be your cinephile, sort of dedicated art house cinema audience that would attend other international festivals, or in Dublin would go to the IFI or Lighthouse regularly. The first year I was very definite. I was like, no, we're not going to have anime at all. And then I sort of realized, well, actually, if we don't include anime or some level of anime within the greater program, you know, we're not going to, we're cutting off certain audiences. And there is, you know, cosplayers and game players and anime fans. That's a huge demographic in Ireland. And there's anime and manga societies in most of the universities around the country. So I kind of rolled back on that then started to program some anime, but we very much wanted it to be a representation of a diverse range of Japanese cinema. So the approach we started to take then was, well, look, let's get a range of different audiences in to see different types of films. And if we can get the anime fans to come in and then try maybe something else in the program, and likewise with the, you know, kind of dedicated cinephiles who might kind of go, oh, I don't know whether that anime isn't really my thing. But as you said, it can be quite fun at some of those screenings. And in the past, we have had, yes, cosplayers come along and be dressed up. And we've had some great photographs from the past, because it's a whole area that to be honest, I wasn't really aware of. And unless you're exposed to that, you might not actually be aware of. But yeah, it can be great fun.
And does it kind of present differently in the different regions? So you have venues like all over Ireland, which is absolutely brilliant. So there's, you know, people are just a drive away from their local screening. So keep an eye out on jff.ie. Tell me about the highlights, your particular highlights of the festival.
Oh my goodness. It's always hard to choose. But I suppose, with the festival, we've always kind of prided ourselves in trying to seek out sort of new talent and emerging talent within the festival. And often we find that we do end up then maybe bringing, you know, kind of are showcasing that talent, the early talent, you know, maybe showing their first, second film or whatever. So in terms of this year, I mean, there's a lot of really good drama in there. Ichiko in particular, I think, is quite an interesting film, kind of twisty turny sort of thriller. About a woman who disappears and her boyfriend trying to kind of figure out why she's disappeared. That's quite an interesting film. One that I think has kind of a more general appeal and is kind of quite feel good as well is Yudo, The Way of the Bath. And that's actually from the screenwriter of Departures, the Japanese film that won the Oscar many years ago. So that's kind of, yeah, it's a very comforting, warm-hearted film, gentle in terms of its comedy. And yeah, we expect that that would be something that Irish audiences in particular, because it also gives insight into this whole idea of the onsen or the communal baths that we're not obviously that familiar with here in Ireland. But yeah, in terms of, I mean, the one that I personally really like is the Opus, the last concert film of Ryuichi Sakamoto, who died last year. And that's, it's just such a, I mean, even if you watch it on your own, you really kind of, it's such a poignant tribute to the man, and you really feel like you're the only person there, and he is the only person he's playing to. It's recorded in a recording studio on his own, but it's just, yeah, it's just a wonderful film. I mean, there's very little dialogue in it. It is primarily him playing his music, but also sort of, you know, constantly sort of trying to, you can see him as an individual. You see him, what type of personality he was. He's kind of, you know, talking to himself. The only dialogue is where he's kind of will say something like, that's not right, or, you know, I must try that again, or so that's that. And it's shot in beautiful black and white. And then I guess for Outside of Dublin, Evil Does Not Exist, as I mentioned earlier, is just, I mean, I'm a big Hamaguchi fan. We've sort of championed him from the very beginning of his career. And this, while it may not be for some people to the same level as his Oscar winner Drive My Car, it is just absolutely beautiful to look at on screen. And again, quite a slow sort of but stirring film, with an ending that will have people scratching their heads or having discussions and conversations and maybe arguments at the end of it. We actually did a preview of that for the launch a few weeks ago. And yes, there was a lot of quite interesting sort of feedback and discussion after we showed that film.
Brilliant. And is there any sort of outliers that maybe people wouldn't expect to see on the roster, or that maybe people haven't seen that type of story before?
Well, I suppose Egoist is quite an interesting film. It's a LGBT love story, and I suppose it's, I mean, we over the years have watched many sort of films where that feature queer stories, but I think the Japanese are still a little bit behind in terms of how culturally, I suppose, how acceptable certain things are in a public arena. And I do feel that Egoist is probably the first film that we've seen that is maybe more real in terms of presenting a real relationship, gay relationship, and also hearing and seeing through the drama what gay people, you know, kind of how that's sort of how it exists within Japanese culture. Because, yeah, I mean, any gay stories that we've seen before are usually very kind of very timid, I guess, whereas this seems much more real. In terms of others, Shinya Tsukamoto, Shadow of Fire, he's always a re not something that you won't have seen before, but he's always a really challenging director in terms of he's very interested in exploring things that, again, you know, maybe are not easy for Japanese people to think about, and also not just Japanese people, but So a lot of his films, and we've shown, I think his last two films are about war or killing or violence, and the impact that can have. And he doesn't shy away from that, but portrays it again, brings sort of the sort of meshes, I guess, the challenge that Japanese people may have in terms of, culturally being able to speak about difficult things, particularly in their past, and trying to bring a resolution to that. So that's, I mean, Japanese people and any of the Japanese people I've met are very gentle people and very sort of demure often, and very polite and respectful. And that's why it's quite interesting when you were talking to Emmy about how Irish people are versus Japanese people. I mean, Japanese people would sit in a cinema to the very end of the credits for the most part. They would never think of, getting up and leaving, because part of the culture would be that that would be a sign of disrespect. And I don't know whether Emmy would have mentioned this, but I know, again, one of the things that I was sort of I'm always taken aback by is that they will, take out their rubbish, they will clean up after them. It would be seen to be disrespectful to not, take your rubbish and clean your area, within, not just in a cinema, within, school, within any sort of public environment like that. So yeah, so that's the, Sakamoto, or Tsukamoto, really sort of tries to address difficult subjects while still, representing quite accurately, Japanese culture and how that meshes together.
And it's a beautiful watch. Thank you so much. It's such a wonderful it's such a like a wonderful selection of films. People will have so much to choose from. So great. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thanks, Gemma. Thank you.
Third Window Films is a UK-based distributor of movies from East Asia that was founded in 2005. They have provided distribution for a number of award-winning films, and I'm delighted to be chatting now with Adam Torrell. Thank you so much for chatting with us from quite far away.
Yes, all the way, many, many hours away. But yes, the time difference makes it quite late for us as well.
Yes, it is. And you're so good. And it's a Friday evening where you are. I'm sure you'd love to have a glass of wine in your hand. So you're very good for chatting to us ahead of the festival, which is really exciting. Access Cinema have a really cool lineup. So first, before we kind of delve into the wonderful films that you have distributed for the festival, I just was wondering if you could, I actually think it's a very interesting role that you have. Can you tell me how you even got into the film industry in the first place and found your way here?
I've been running this company, Third Window Films, which is a company I started about 20 years ago. And the whole goal was to distribute Japanese films and Asian films that are not the obvious types of films. I started off with Korean films from a director called Lee Chang-dong, who now is quite, he's won Oscars and all, but at the time he wasn't very well known, and his films didn't sell very well either, unfortunately. But my whole passion is all about finding obscure cinema and trying very hard to make people see it, because I wonder, there's all these great films out there, and yet it's the same old films that get distributed all over and again. It's the same studio films from Japan. It's the same Kurosawa and Ozu, and of course we love those films, but there's millions of other films that don't get seen. So I've spent my life trying to put the spotlight on these sort of more obscure films from Asia.
And even to the point where you got to where you saw that there was a gap in that market, and that, these films aren't having the life and access to audiences that they should have, even before you got there, what were you doing that got you to that space? Like did you do film in college? And then I know you were interning in Tartan Films for a while. How did you kind of get to the position where you were like, all right, this is definitely what I want to do? Because setting up your business, that entrepreneurial spirit, like it's a tough one to start.
Actually, I'm English, but I lived in America when I was a teenager, and I lived in a very small town in Florida called Sarasota. Florida's not the most cultured place in the world, but for some reason, in this small town of Sarasota, I had this unbelievable video rental store that, if it was in a bigger city in the world like New York or London, would be no known worldwide. I mean, we had about 50,000 films, and it was owned by these two guys who made their money in real estate and were just huge hardcore film fans. So from the 80s, they just bought every single movie that ever came out on VHS. They just never threw anything away, whether they liked it or not. They just bought everything and stored it and stored it and stored it and rented it out as a sort of personal, a video shop, but it was sort of like their own personal archive. And I would attend that show when I was a young teenager, or 12 or 13 and 14 and all that. And I was got into films, and I was but because and I would really go to their video shop a lot. And I ended up also working at a cinema in the area that showed independent films, and just watched movies all the time there. And then I ended up going to a university and going to film school and learning film theory, but also at the same time started working at these local cinemas and independent shops. And that got me sort of, I mean, this was obviously before the internet, and before it was easily accessible to see so many movies around the world. And it was the concept of, well, why are these movies in this shop? How are people seeing these movies? Well, we're telling people who come to the shop to watch certain movies. But then again, how did the movies come in the shop in the first place? Well, they need to be distributed. And if they aren't distributed, then how can we see them? How can we show them to people? So the concept of film distribution became quite interesting to me. And around time that I became about 20, I moved back to the UK from living there in Florida. And at the time, Tartan Films was a company who was handling a lot of quite niche, and especially a lot of Asian films, especially from Japan and Korea and all that. And I started interning for them and learning more about the ins and outs of the business, the distribution business itself. So that's how I got started. And then, yes, ended up doing my own company soon after.
That's fabulous. And tell me about what was the prompt? Like, when did you say, okay, that's it. I'm gonna start my own company. I can do this. Like, was there a push? Was there like a moment that you were like, this film is not getting the space it deserved? Like, what were the kind of factors that like really pushed you out there? Because it's a risk starting your own company and your own business and building that network. You obviously had it because you were working in the industry, but like to be recognized.
I mean, I loved initially the reason why I started working for Tartan Films is because I was a huge fan of what they were doing. But when I started working, it was sort of the peak, and then going down from the industry in terms of DVDs and physical media, and sort of, I guess, even Asian genre cinema at the time. Sort of end of the J-horror, J-horror and all that peaked in like the 2000 with films like The Ring and Audition and Battle Royale, and started going down. And Tartan kept on doing a lot of just the same old types of films, just trying to make a buck. I mean, it's a business, so what can you do? And they were releasing, like, just the quality was getting worse and worse, but they were still releasing these sorts of films. And I would go to the boss there and the people there and say, you know what, even within what you're trying to do, and just this business-wise, there are much better films. Why don't we try to do those? And I would always argue with them. So I said, well, let me try to just do it myself, and I'll help you and buy films and put my money into it, and you can distribute it, so you can take the glory, and I'll be happy that these films get out there. And when I approached this to them, they fired me on the spot, actually. So that was
So you were pushed. God,
yeah, so that's exactly how it started.
that's so interesting. And okay, so how do you start? So you have the connections from working there, you have the drive. Is it a case of going to production companies, finding them there? Is it a case of going to festivals after festivals? What do you do to start growing your business then?
Yeah, it was a mix of obviously going to festivals. At the time, there weren't that many people doing, like, especially Japanese films. So I guess you could take control of a situation quite easily. And it was also before many people knew of what many Japanese films were out there because there wasn't that much access to them. So I would go to Japan and go to Korea and meet all these directors and producers and studios and start to become quite friendly with them and working with them. And I think because I was one of the few people that was doing that at the time, it was quite easy to get my foot in the door. And then I learned the language of Japanese, and that helped me reach to people who wouldn't have any international presence because they didn't speak the English or couldn't go overseas because they weren't able to communicate. So I managed to carve out a niche of working. I mean, it is just with a lot of niche films, to be honest, but I guess within that niche market, I was able to establish myself over time.
And so you kind of you're coming in the era of Blu-rays, and it's moving on, or like DVDs, Blu-rays, and then it's moving on to Blu-rays, and then on to online. How did you find the market has shifted, or was starting to shift in that time? And did that work for you, or against you, or did it pose challenges?
Yeah, I came in at absolutely the worst time that anybody should come in. It was 2005 that I set up, and that was the peak of physical media, and it only went down from then. And except it started going down quite rapidly as I started, and it actually took 2 years to get my first release out in 2007. It was a film called Greenfish by Lee Chang-dong, which is actually now being re-released in cinemas worldwide because it's now being considered as this great debut film from one of the world's most well-known directors, but he wasn't popular at the time because he wasn't such a well-known director then. And it was a mixture of that, and yes, the market was going down badly, and a lot of companies were going under, including Tartan Films, and it was a bit of a sink and or swim situation for the first few years. And then I think the market sort of stabled, and I think a lot of also. Because I was coming in at a time that things were very hot, it was hard to negotiate with a lot of big companies because they were expecting the market to be as it had been over the past few years. So you're buying stuff at the premium, and then it's losing its sales potential very quickly. And that sort of evened out over the years. And I think a lot of people overseas in Japan and Asia also realized that we can't charge the prices we have been doing because the markets aren't as good there, and there's less people buying our films because there's no markets. And it did take a little while to actually do anything decent with the company. The first few years are pretty awful, to be honest. But because I do everything myself, I don't really have any overheads, and I guess that's how I've managed to survive in that time. And that's how I do continue to survive, is just by doing absolutely every aspect of the company myself, with no office or no staff or anything. It's a bit of a one-man job.
That sounds very tough because, I mean, you're nurturing two like different like bunch of different layers of relationships, of titles. So, just say now, would you have titles on your books that you would like, what would the majority of your business consist of in terms of getting films seen here?
I think nowadays what I do is I have a bit more of a larger scale approach to films. So I take a film from a very early stage of its process, either when it's in pre-production or even from maybe a script stage, or come in as not just a distributor, but the world sales rights holder of the film. And I bring the film to film festivals, create a market for the film myself that is worldwide, as in getting it to press in different countries, in different languages, in different festivals worldwide. So before it comes to the fact that it needs to be distributed on video or Blu-ray or internet, it's already quite a well-known title. I think if you wait, or if you don't have as much control, and you let the Japanese aren't so good with an international side. If you let them handle it all, it becomes a bit of a mess by the time you end up trying to distribute it yourself. So I need to do a lot more for each title than I used to, and I guess that's why it's a bit more also financially successful in that respect.
So you would have to do the marketing for a film in a region where you don't even necessarily speak the language fully. That's very impressive. Like, and getting the word out and getting it to festivals. So what would you, so you'd go to all the big international film festivals with a metaphorical suitcase full of films that you're really, really excited about that you've all the documentation for? And I presume you'd have to translate a lot of this yourself and to repackage it in a way that like suits the tastes of the people buying the films.
Well, I guess the thing about film festivals is film festivals do a lot of that stuff for you. So you normally present a film to a film festival and they would have their own press team, have their own subtitlers and such. And therefore, you know, it can be very advantageous for you to, for that film festival to play your film so that it's easier to sell that film to that that market, or even have a distributor from that local country want to buy the film, because a lot of the work that is done by the film festival. So film festivals are very important in getting the word out there and obviously doing things that I wouldn't be able to do, because obviously I don't, as you mentioned, I don't speak all these languages and I'm not everywhere at one time.
Yeah, it sounds like you're nearly half everywhere at one time with all that work. Oh my God. And do you find there's like politics to selling films in different regions? Say like, does North America have a different taste or prefer things packaged in a specific way than your like Western Europe? And would Eastern Europe be into specific types of films? Like, is there any kind of trends that you notice? You're like, oh yeah, the English will love this. They'll love it, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, especially even within Europe, like France and Italy, for example. Italy really loves like melodramatic films, and obviously the English prefer a little darker and maybe a bit more cynical. And the French, you know, especially for Japanese films, they like very, very Japanese, you know, like sort of like samurai and tea and all that sort of stuff that is a bit very classic. But the English prefer a little more, yes, a stranger type of surreal type films, while in America it's a bit more obvious. So yeah, I think each country has its own way and a way of marketing as well. So I think not just as a distributor in England myself, but as a sales agent for Japanese, I know that maybe this film would work better in one country and not another. And obviously the financial aspect of that as well has to be taken into consideration when I'm working with all these buyers from overseas.
And how many titles would you say have? Would you like say have active titles that are like your kind of top picks, other titles that you're like pull out of the bag if people are looking for something else? And then would you have kind of like fallow titles then that would like, you know, like maybe it's not their time at the moment? How do you sort of pick how things are being? Because I presume it's like you're selling these films to other festivals around the world and to you know, different venues and different spaces. And I'm just curious to what that entails.
I mean, basically, because I'm only one person, I can only do so much. But also within that, my one person, I'm handling distribution of films within the UK itself, and that's the titles that a specific amount of titles and maybe 12 films a year that are just distributing only in the UK. And then I have these films that I'm doing worldwide that is maybe only 2 or 3 films a year, because I need to bring it to like 50 or 100 film festivals and obviously make sure that even just the prints go from here to there and all the materials are there, and then also at the same time introducing it to other film festivals, planning which gets the premiere and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, and on the top of that, I also produce films as well within Japan. So trying to balance all these things, I can't do so many films a year. It's only a few handful that if I'm distributing it, it can be this sort of type, because maybe it's for England, but if it's world sales, it needs to be a bigger title because it takes more time and it needs to have be more sellable. So but there are, and then sometimes I've had some films that like I've put loads of time in and like they don't sell at all and they don't play any film festivals. So it can just be a bit of a waste of time. So I need to be a bit more careful about that with kids nowadays as well too.
God, I presume if something is such a passion and you really have to get behind it like 110%, I think, do you really have to absolutely adore the film, or like can you have a bit of cynicism and go, this isn't for me, but I know that like it's a bit melodramatic, but I know those French people will do so well. Like, is there an element to that, or are you like, no, I believe in this and this has to be seen and this has to go out, or like do you do both? What's the kind of ethos behind how you get behind a film?
I mean, I'm not a businessman in that respect. Like, I'm not somebody who like maybe I could, but I wouldn't want to sell something that I didn't feel behind. I'm passionate about things, and I can only speak well and sell something if I feel very strong about it. And I'd also feel very guilty about something if I was trying to, sell something that isn't good, because also I think if I'm not if I have a big company, I have a big name about me, then it's one thing. But when you're one person, you can trust is very important, and you need to really believe about something so that the other person will understand you and believe you. And I don't want to sell something to somebody, and then if they get turned off by that, they don't think it's very good. If I present a film to a film festival that the film festival might not like, then next time they're not going to want to talk to me. So I need to really match something that I feel passionate about with somebody that would also share my passion as well. It's no point trying to sell something to somebody that is different to you or has a different taste to you. It's just a bit of a waste of time, I think, for everybody. So yeah, it tends to be for films that I'm passionate about. And otherwise, it's of course, yes, I could make more money if I was like, selling product to people in a way that people buy products. And but I'm not that sort of person, I guess.
And tell me about your customers that you are selling to, in the sense where it's film festivals is where it gets seen, but I presume the people going, yeah, we want to have it for a week, are independent art house cinemas, like local community, like where, like smaller film festivals. I'm just curious to how you, or like who wants to see these films and crave these beautiful niche films that, are, and they're seeking them out.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it is obviously important to make sure that the fit they match. So, example, if you have a film festival, the type of films that they've played in the past usually correlates to the audience that they have, and that audience is passionate for certain types of films, and those films meet the film that they play match the films that you're trying to present to them. And if it's a big enough film festival, obviously there's Cannes and all that, but apart from that, there's hundreds or thousands of other great film festivals, big and small. And you need to have these festivals that have that core audience that will what go there and watch the film, whether they know it or not, because they trust the film festival, and then continue to support that film in other formats afterwards. And of course, there's big film festivals, there's small film festivals, there's local cinemas. For example, one of the films that's playing at Access Cinemas Japan Film Festival, Typhoon Club, from the 1985, which is one of mine, is played yesterday in Bristol at the Cube Cinema. And the Cube Cinema is quite a local, independently run one screen cinema with 105 seats, but it's quite well curated, and it sold out on a Wednesday night last night, or well, whenever Wednesday was, I forget what day we are now. But I think, it's important to have, don't just put your film in a big cinecon just because it's a big cinecon. Like, if the audience aren't the correct people for that film, then it could just be nobody would can't turn up. So you really have to find all these cinemas and interact with them, whether it be a film festival or a local cinema, and make sure that, you can build an audience together, or you can work together to help that audience grow.
And let's talk about those films, since you brought them up. There are two beautiful films that are screening as part of the festival. Typhoon Club. Tell me about how you got involved in that project. It's so poignant. You're as a in the film industry, you're always told like a local story that sells internationally or that has international appeal, and that's the sort of thing everyone's aiming for. But this definitely is something so unique in voice, and even the title is reminiscent of Breakfast Club, of all those coming of age classics that we would have grown up watching, coming from across the pond in America. And there's nods to that, but then there's just such a strength in culture and voice, and it's so unique. Was this something that you have on a shelf and you bring it out to people? Is this something you acquired recently? It's stunning.
This will get quite film nerdy and hardcore right now, but so I apologize to people
That's
who may be
the
listening.
way we like it here. That is exactly us.
Typhoon Club was a film from a production company in the 80s of Japan called the Directors Company, and the Directors Company was a film company made of directors, as the name sounds. And those were nine independent film directors from that time who were all young. They were all in their 30s when they started this company in 1982. And some of them became quite well known, like Kiyoshi Kurosawa, who is director of Cure and Cairo, and recently the Venice Film Festival winner of Wife of a Spy. He had a film in Berlin a couple of months ago. He's one of the biggest names nowadays in Japan, but he started within that company. And another one was this director of Typhoon Club, a director called Shinji Somai. And Shinji Somai is considered to be one of the greatest names of his generation, yet he's very, very unknown outside of Japan. And recently, so this company was around from 1982 to 1992, then it went bankrupt because if you let directors, film directors, run a company and make their own films, then they're going to make really, really, commercial films, and then they all go bankrupt. So it went bankrupt quite quickly. And this Typhoon Club was one of the seminal films from that company and this director, Shinji Somai, and lost for years. But up a few years ago, a friend of mine discovered a lot of negative prints, the original camera negatives for many of these films from this company, and therefore we could start the process of restoring them. And once you restore films, obviously it makes them lovely and clean, and it makes them sort of new again, which you can bring to film festivals because film festivals like brand new restorations of old classic films. So in this case, Typhoon Club was one of them. And luckily, Ryusuke Hamaguchi, the director of Drive My Car, is one of the big fans of Shinji Somai, one of the directors that inspired him to become a filmmaker. And he brought that film with its new restoration to the Berlin Film Festival last year. And he curated it and programmed this film. And it sort of helped it now become the sort of long lost cult film that has never been seen. And with that new master, I'm now bringing it around to screen in Access Cinema. And it's actually already out on Blu-ray and on in the United Kingdom. So it's really a phenomenal film of its time. It's not really for everyone, for sure. But if you like Hamaguchi, then you should watch it for sure.
And I'm just wondering, so to distribute a film like this, is it exciting to get, something that you have known about and cared about for so long in front of audiences?
Oh, for sure. I mean, for films like these, and from this company, I've been working a lot with this remastering these directors' company films. They've been essentially lost for decades, and you hear a lot of people talk about them, but nobody's actually ever seen them. And to be able to finally get this film out there, it's like really like just discovering treasure. And also with brand new masters, they look great as well. And it's very important for film history, to make sure these people, I mean, the director himself died many years ago, but to keep him alive and have all these new people watch these films, which if you're going to a film festival like Access Cinema's Japan Film Festival, it's a mixture of mostly new contemporary Japanese films, but also mixing it up with a film like this, which is a classic that is not Kurosawa, it's not Ozu, it's a classic from the 80s that really hasn't been seen. So the chance to see it on the big screen is incredibly rare. So I really hope that people take that chance.
And then to go from that one to another one that was quite it was quite an intense watch, Shadow of Fire. Oh my God. Like what a roller coaster of emotions, but beautifully filmed, and insular one, like three-hander at the beginning, two-hander then turns to three-hander, and very much so in a weird way uncomfortably timely in that it examines the horrors of war. Can you talk to me about this title and the background?
Yeah, I've been working with its director Shinya Tsukamoto for many years. I mean, he's really one of the most famous Japanese cult directors of since the 80s. His film Tetsuo the Iron Man is really one of the most talked about cult films of all time, whether in Japan or anywhere else. And it really inspired many directors out there. So he's got a long career, and I've been working releasing his films and remastering his films for well over a decade, or maybe even 15 years or so since I've been working with him. So I've always handled his latest films, and he doesn't make many films, but he only makes good films. He's really puts a lot of work into each film, like 3, 4 years. He's not one of the the directors to just bam, 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 a film every year. He's spends years on each film, and they're all. I don't think he's never made a bad film at all. He's made about 15 films, and he's made some that aren't as great as the last one, but they're all like 7 out of 10s and more. And this is part of a trilogy that he's been doing, an anti-war trilogy, a sort of looking at film, looking at eras, at the end of eras. In this case, this is after the firebombing, and or in Japan, and the what's happened after the war. And a previous one, he did a film called Killing, which is sort of the end of the samurai era. And before that, the first part in this sort of trilogy was Fires on a Plane. It was about Japanese left in the Philippines after the war who turned to cannibalism. Also quite a fun film. Not at all fun. No. So they're very quite dark films, but they're incredibly powerful. I mean, they're very low budget, but he's got a very unique style that sets him apart from the majority of filmmakers out there. So whether you like it or not, I mean, you'll be in one camp or the other, for sure, I think. But I don't think you can deny that the power of this film and all his films in general. So it's yeah, I think especially on the big screen, this film on the big screen has a much different experience than watching it at home.
That sounds so interesting. So you were saying you get on at like almost you can get on a pre-production level. I mean, I presume if you're getting on board with something and it's pre-production, would you like these are people you'd have a relationship with, and after like other than that, people would sell you things maybe in post, like when they're hitting their post and go, "This is the rough cut."
Yeah, I mean that happens a lot. I mean, recently, I do prefer obviously the final film. I mean, I remember a few years ago, even it was a director that I totally loved, and I've worked on all his films, and I've actually it was the only film that I'd bought ever without seeing it. I saw some footage of it, and I just loved the director. And I thought because I had actually bought the rights to his films and turned him into a quite well-known director overseas. And that actually became a bit of a double-edged sword because when his new films came out, a lot of competitors tried to buy them over me. So I thought, in this case, I need to get in early. And I bought the film, and then when I saw the final product, like I said, I hated it. So
Oh
I
no.
had to find another distributor in England to take it off my hands. But I don't do that as much, obviously. I don't do it at all nowadays. But in the case of like Shinya Tsukamoto with Shadow of Fire. I mean, I wait to see the film to make a decision, but I just trust him. I've distributed every single one of his films, and I know that he'll make something fantastic and do what I can to help him. Because also, a distributor is important to be there is important for the director because we're obviously giving money back to the film that he's put money into himself. It's important.
The business aspect is very interesting as well. So is it something like where he'd give you like a retainer up front and then there'd be like a cut of the sales that happens? Or, you know, do you sign a contract to sale, get X amount of sales, and then once my fee is paid, you'll get X, Y, and Z. And then what if it doesn't make it? Is it like, okay, you're relying on like one or two hits out of three mediums and then hoping there's not a flaw? Like, what, how does the financing sort of work?
I mean, there's different, obviously, in producing a film or just buying a film as a distributor, and also where, if you're buying it from the producer or the director himself or through a sales company. And, it also, if I'm trying to buy from a sales company, I'm trying to not pay them as much because they're just a company in themselves. But if I'm buying from a director, I obviously want to help him out as much as I can and therefore to give as much back ends as possible. And, in the case of some of the people that I work with, I do really give them a lot more, even sometimes more than I probably should, but just to help them out if I know that they're not doing well themselves or trying to finance their next film. But if I'm working for if I bought a film from a big company, I'm obviously don't really care because I know that they're just going to put it in their pockets and they're not going to send it back to the director. There's various ways of doing it, but sometimes if I have a film that does very well and I've negotiated it in a way that royalties, well, most films I'll pay royalties back to them depending on how much I paid up front. So if I pay them an amount up front and it doesn't recoup that amount, then obviously no royalties. But if it recoups that and then royalties get paid back to them, if that's the state of the initial deal, then yes, they will go, money will go back to them. But in sometimes, actually many times, the films don't even break even, and therefore, well, you know, that's that, I guess. So there are just obviously a lot of costs about putting out films, you know, subtitling, BBFC, which are very, very expensive for film certificates, including even in Ireland, and you know, all these other costs, making the Blu-rays and advertising and this and that. So
And would you
well,
have prints? Would you get prints done in DCPs and things as well, or they kind of come with the filmmaker get them? I suppose you'd have probably have to do them with subtitles.
I mean, in most cases, because obviously we're in English language, a director or a producer or a production company in Japan or anywhere, they want their film to go to film festivals, right? So they'll make English subtitles themselves, and therefore make the DCPs and bring it to film festivals. Sometimes with older films that I do as a buyer or even a sales agent, they might have nothing, no subtitles, no DCPs, no materials at all, and I'll need to do the work from scratch and make the subtitles, sometimes remaster the films from the negatives
Yeah.
or this or that. And yeah, it can I don't like doing all that sort of stuff, but sometimes it needs to be done, or else you can't distribute it.
And you're someone who's watched like so many films. So like, and if you're getting involved with something sort of like at the production level, you were like, this has been done before, it doesn't work. I'm just telling you now, I've seen so many films, it doesn't work. Like, would you sort of give notes like that, but maybe like in a more friendly way or anything like that? To go like, look, that's like it, the pacing is too slow or too fat. Like, would you give those notes at that level, or would you say that's for the
Yeah, I mean, as a distributor, in that, if I'm in that case, a distributor, usually I'm getting that film later
done?
on, and I don't, I can try, but I don't think they'd listen. But as a, if I'm a, as a producer, which I have for many films, yes, I've told them, and in some cases, you know, Japanese don't like a big Westerner coming over and saying do this and do that, because it's very stereotypical, isn't it? So what I've done is I've taken the film and had and re-edited it myself or with an editor, and then shown it to the director and say, look, we've changed this. Like, what do you think? Do you like this or no? You know, we don't have to go with this, but from what my advice is that this rhythm will work much better overseas, and what do you think? And obviously I'll try to maybe persuade them a little more, because I know that maybe the cut that they've given me isn't going to work as well, and as a producer, I also need to sort of recoup the costs that have been put into the production of the film. So obviously I'm not like Harvey Weinstein, who's just like cutting, like, you know, cutting the films like left, right, and center, and then changing the name in some stupid way just to make it more sellable. You know, I do have the best interests of the director at heart, but I think in Japan, post-production is not as big a thing as it is overseas, because in Japan it's a very unique market in the fact that basically most films make them are aimed only domestically. They have no interest about the international market, because they make their money back domestically. And in order to make your money domestically, not what matters is how good the film is, because there's no film critics here. It's just like the cast. And I mean, like it used to be in Hollywood many, many years ago, but basically the cast is usually like idols or like models or something like that, or not actors in the way that West we are have in the West. And therefore you get a lot of crap, but it sells, because that's what the audience is used to there. And a lot of TV spin-offs shot in the same way as TV, like on the big screen, they look awful. And in those cases, you know, it's a you get a lot of terrible films that aren't they don't pay the attention to, because they don't need to get it overseas, you know. Like in the for example, Korean cinema, the reason why Korean cinema is so popular overseas over the last few years is because a lot of the people that are created the structure of the Korean film industry had the mind of going internationally, including the government. The government put a lot of money and time into promoting Korean cinema, Korean culture, Korean pop, and all that sort of stuff overseas. So you have this incredibly glossy, really stylized look or sound to the music, because they're going for the international market. They know you can't have like crap, or else people aren't going to buy it. But Japan is the complete opposite of that. They just focus inwards, and therefore, even if they do crap, nobody's going to complain about it anyway. So it's I do have spent a lot of time trying to tell people here, like, you know, there's a reason why Korean films are successful overseas, and you do need to make things look a little better and have a better rhythm to them when they're in editing and have better sound design and all that. So it's a bit of a tug and war, to be honest.
And has there ever been a film that has broken your heart for like whatever reason? You know, like maybe it hasn't gotten the audience it should have. Maybe, you know, it started off with such promise and like that fell down in post. What were the sort of projects that like broke your heart? And then we'll do a positive one at the end to go, oh, the ones that are the your favorite. Yeah.
I've got probably have a lot to be honest, but yeah, actually bringing it back to the start of a conversation with Lee Chang-dong, because Lee Chang-dong is now this super established director, and I loved his films because they're amazing, and I put a lot of work into getting them out there, but it was before he became well known. They just weren't popular, and I was wondering like why aren't these amazing films popular in the way that they should be? So that was quite stressful, to be honest. I'm sure I have a million other examples in between, but I've forgotten everything.
And is do you have like sort of your package to go? Like there are films that will sell themselves, and all I have to do is kind of like get them in front of the right people and make an introduction. And then there are films that you have to like go, I have to go into the kind of woodwork to find people. But I do believe when they get to the right people that they'll go. And then ones that don't. Like, is there different sort of like experiences that you have with different projects? Like, and are the ones that make it the ones you would have thought that would have made it? Like, could you have seen that in them early on? Like, I know there's something that you'd go to in every project, as you said, but is there ones, you know, like some have like a spark, you know, like that you are like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when you see a film and it's just like amazing, like films like I've handled films like One Cut of the Dead or Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes, films that I've handled the world sales for, even for distribution films like Confessions, or Kamikaze Girls, Memories of Matsuko, or it's just like pff, like that's just amazing film. Like, and it's not just amazing. I mean, there are amazing films. Like I released this one film called Hangong Ju, a Korean film that is just amazing, but it's really heavy, and it did awfully. And I realized I did it because it's nobody, you wouldn't want to watch it again ever because it's just like it's such a hard, it's one of the best films I've ever seen in my life. I'll never ever watch it again. And I didn't think about that because usually if you're selling stuff, it's like especially physical products like Blu-rays or DVDs, it's, somebody wants to keep it and watch it again, not just like watch it once and throw it away. But I think there are obviously more glossy films like ones I just mentioned, like Confessions, Kamikaze Girls, where you can see just not just is it like a good story and entertaining and well acted, but it also has that visual flair and the entertainment factor that makes people want to revisit it. And I think in those cases, it's quite obvious that they'll do well. Sometimes they do a lot better than I expect, but obviously I also have times when they do a lot less than I expect, but I can't really bring so many to mind. Except for Hangong Ju and some others.
Can you see a change in voice happening? Like, can you see sort of like leanings towards certain trends in terms of style or storytelling in different areas? And like, where, like, would you have any examples of that?
I mean, obviously, over the past few years, due to like, A24, you have this sort of like, intelligent genre films, films that are. I mean, recently genre films have become a lot more popular and mainstream, than I mean, there was always niche markets within horror and slashers, but now they've become a bit more mainstream because of companies like A24 who have made these like stylish, like slasher films, but like intelligent. So you reach like this much wider audience. So you have the art house crowd and you also have the genre crowd, and it blends them all together in a way that is quite relatively new in that respect. And because of that, a lot of people over a lot of filmmakers overseas try to do similar things. It's trends in that respect. So I guess that's genre films in all respects have become a lot more than like B movies nowadays. They what used to be B movies are now A movies, and therefore genre films is something that I've been focusing a lot more. I think if you have a human drama, if it's really good, it's really good. But if it's not really good, it's really shit. Like, so with a genre film, like if some of its parts of it is good, like you can get away with it as a whole. Like if it's a bit of action that's decent, the rest of it can be a bit crap, but like people will still like it. But like if it's like a really heavy human drama, it's just like not that good. It's just like it's shit. So I think that's why I guess genre films has been popular for most people and also for myself and what I've been distributing.
And finally, tell me about the project that has been the inspiration, the one that kind of keeps you going when you're when you know when there's no nibbles out in the sales department, the one that you're like, okay, that's the golden child of your film stock.
I mean, I've got the most relatively recent one was this called One Cut of the Dead, which was this film shot made in a sort of what called a workshop in which it was like a sort of school project in essence. A small school for actors had made a film as a workshop because to teach these actors how to be in a film. And I guess once the you basically make a film as part of the school project, and that film cost like $20,000. It was just a small film, and it ended up grossing in Japanese cinema $30 million. That well, I didn't get any of that, unfortunately.
Oh
I did
no,
get
damn it.
the worldwide rights to that film at an early stage, and it became this huge success. And I managed to sell it to a lot of big companies for big money, and also distribute it myself. And that was a, that's a film that is a fantastic independent film that you shouldn't read up about before you watch it, but everybody should watch it and stick with it because it really goes in the directions that are very, very unique and fun and silly. And it's like that it's very B movie genre, but it's got lots of twists and turns that make you think. That's yeah, for sure one that I has been financially beneficial and helps me release a lot of the films that I love that don't make any money whatsoever.
The Japanese Film Festival takes place from the 9th to the 27th of April at venues around the country. Get your tickets now at jff.ie.